I'd like to welcome and introduce our keynote speaker, Professor Gary Sheffield. Professor Sheffield teaches in the Department of War Studies at the University of Wolverhampton. He's a military historian. He has many publications, radio and television broadcasts to his name, including his 2011 monograph, The Chief Douglas Haig in the British Army, and his most recent publication, published only a couple of weeks ago, Command and Morale. He's been described as one of Britain's foremost historians of the First World War, and we're delighted to have him here today. And alongside his many and various other commitments, Gary contributed an article to the British Library's recently launched First World War learning website, World War I, so special thanks to you from me for that. So we're very, very pleased that you're able to join us today, and we look forward to hearing what I'm sure will be a very challenging and thought-provoking speech. Please welcome Professor Gary Sheffield.
Well, thank you very much. What Abby kindly didn't mention was the amount of time it took me actually to get this article to her. But anyway, that's another matter. Very busy academic life for all of us at the moment. I've just returned from the battlefields of the First World War. I was there with a party last week. I go actually to study military actions on the ground. I'm actually not much given to emoting in cemeteries. But you cannot help but see the physical aftermath of war in the shape of those beautiful cemeteries in France and Flanders. And reading the inscriptions on headstones, they can be absolutely heartbreaking. And I should say on a personal note, as the father of a son who, had he been alive a century ago, would have been a precisely the right age to join the army and fight on the Western Front, I find all this almost unbearably poignant. It certainly forces one to ask the big question, whether it was all worth it. And reading newspapers, watching at least some TV programmes, and listening to or reading some novelists, such as one of our speakers today, Michael Morpurgo, or some historians, such as Neil Ferguson, it's easy to assume that the answer to the question, was it all worth it, is a straightforward no. That the First World War was a pointless and futile conflict, and British generals were nothing better than murderers. So deep-seated is this view that to put forward a contrary argument, as I have frequently discovered in the now three-decade academic career, is to encounter resistance, anger, and sometimes outright hostility that manifests itself in personal abuse. I have a prize collection what's technically known to historians as nutter letters on that level. So I chose my title today very carefully. The view I'm about to put forward is undoubtedly unpopular with many people, quite possibly with some here in the audience today. I'm going to argue that the First World War was not the picture that is commonly depicted and the view that commonly believed. Most, in fact, I think, that is written in the media about the First World War, and some of the stuff that's actually taught, not all I'm certainly aware of, is plain wrong. In my view, and in the view of many historians, the First World War was a just war, forced upon Britain by the aggression of a brutal, militarist, aggressive, expansionist state, bent on achieving hegemony by military conquest, that the vast majority of the British people understood what was at stake and supported the war, and that the generals, far from being murderously incompetent donkeys, were men who undoubtedly made mistakes which had bloody consequences, but grappled successfully under conditions of appalling difficulty with unprecedented changes in warfare. So that by 1918, the British Army was a highly skilled instrument of war which took the lead in defeating the German army in open battle, achieving in the process the greatest victory in British history. Well, sorry, I should have put that up earlier. Let's move on to that. In January, I was minding my own business one morning when I came across an article written by Michael Gove. Which I'm sure you're all aware of the Govegate, in which he blamed the negative view of the First World War on left-wing historians and teachers who rely on Blackadder as evidence, And to my embarrassment, he actually named me as a good historian who gets the right view. Yeah, I know. Actually, he's right about one thing. I think he is right that the general view of the First World War is wrong. Where he gets it very badly wrong is to suggest it's a left-right divide. Actually, my politics on the left. I'm a paid-up Guardian reader, with all that implies. And there are historians who take broadly my view of events who are on the right, on the left, or are apolitical. Should actually say, actually, that I've got lots of friends who are teachers, and I got a text from one of them along the lines of, do you have any influence over your new best friend's policies? Answer, sadly, no. But I think, you know, I think Govegate, I think, was... He made some fairly, I thought, fairly cheap political points, but his broader points about the cultural influence on the way we view the history of the First World War actually has something behind it. Well, Michael Morpargo's books will be far more influential than anything I'll ever write or say, but I should actually say that I fundamentally disagree with his interpretation, or some aspects, I should say, of his interpretation of the First World War. I'm not denying for one moment his right to put his perspective, or for that matter, the right of authors to spin imaginative fiction out of real-life events. But I look at his work from the perspective of a historian who works with a basis of facts and interpretation. Take just something that Michael Morpurgo wrote in his book Private Peaceful. At the very end, after the story is finished, and I know this because my son read it for GCSE English, he then has an after note about the British Army's disciplinary system, and he denounces it. He attacks the execution of two soldiers for, quote, simply sleeping at their posts. To put it no more strongly, this comment displays a lack of understanding of the realities of trench warfare. For a man, for a century, is what we're talking about, to fall asleep at his post was not a trivial matter. It was a very serious offence indeed, which could have endangered the lives of his comrades. That's why it's serious. A sleeping sentry could allow an enemy raiding party into their trenches with potentially catastrophic consequences. So, simply sleeping at their posts, I think, shows a gross misunderstanding of the reality of war between 14 and 18. Also, what doesn't enter into this bald statement, really the story, is that sympathetic officers who knew exactly what the pressures were on their men struggling to stay awake when on sentry duty would deliberately come towards them on patrol at night making a lot of noise precisely to wake them up if they were dozing. Also, it's worth bearing in mind of the 5 million plus men who served in the army between 14 and 18, only about 350 were executed. And in fact, something like 90% of those condemned to death were not actually executed. The sentences were commuted. The fact that only two were shot for sleeping at their post, I think, is also telling. The two men involved were from the same battalion, and it's basically the same incident, Private Thomas Downing and Private Robert Burton of the 6th King's, the 6th Somerset Light Infantry, not on the Western Front at all, but in Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, in February 1917. There were, it's clear from the court-martial transcripts, no extenuating circumstances, and their corps commander, Lieutenant General Marshall, wrote of Burton that the actual fact that he was sitting down shows such a want of appreciation of his duties as a sentry and responsibility for the lives of his comrades that he believed the sentence should be carried out. Now, Catherine Corns and John Hughes Wilson, whose book on the executions is well worth reading as a sober, factual and analytical counterpoint to the likes of this, they make the point that Marshall probably was being overzealous. He probably would not have been shot on the Western Front even for desertion at that time. But there were several points, so they were unlucky in other words, several points worth emerging here. Firstly, we should not attempt to apply the attitudes of the 21st century to the people and the circumstances of 100 years ago. Cliche, past is a different country, they do things differently there, and it's absolutely true when looking at the First World War. Second point I think we need to take on board, that this is an army involved in a total war. A war, a struggle for survival. And under such circumstances, peacetime norms, even the peacetime norms of 1914, to some degree get pushed aside. The third point is that military justice, put justice in inverted commas, isn't really about justice as we understand it today at all. It's not about making sure that individuals get, about making sure that individuals got their just deserts. Actually, it was about ensuring the discipline of the army. And the thinking appears to be behind the decision to shoot these two men is that the army in Mesopotamia is getting a bit slack. This is a particularly flagrant case of sleeping on post. And you shoot a couple to make sure the others don't do it. It's brutal, it's unfair in an individual sense, but it's the way they thought in 1914-18, the way they would have phrased it as, it's better that a couple of people die than many people die as a result of negligence of sentries and all that that implies in terms of letting enemy into your trench. I told you I was going to have an unpopular view. Okay, well, all of this brings me to one of my fundamental points, is that people who sort of look upon the war from a cultural perspective, without really understanding the history of the time and the attitudes of the time, I think tend to fundamentally miss the point. One of the most interesting versions of that recently came out about a year ago, in May 2013, when a group of actors, musicians, poets and politicians published a letter in The Guardian attacking the government's remembrance programme, declaring, far from being a war to end all wars or a victory for democracy, the First World War was a military disaster and a human catastrophe. Few people would deny the last bit, but the earlier bits are very, very dubious. This promptly became known in some circles as the Lovey's Letter. Paul Lay, the editor of History Today, responded by tweeting, tell you what, instead of asking about historians about remembering the war, let's ask the Lovey's. Followed up with another tweet. Next, Jude Law, Kate Hudson and Brian Eno present a paper on treating acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Well, Lay's point was exaggerated, but typically astute. Historical research and analysis are highly specialised activities. And more than most historical events, the First World War prompts people to go public with views based on emotion, limited knowledge, and flawed understanding. Okay, well, let me just tell you about what I think that the outlines of the, if you like, the true history of the First World War is. The first one is to address head-on the question of the origins of the war. I think most people taking their cue from Baldrick in Blackadder see the war as being a trivial event which should not have escalated to the disastrous catastrophe that it was, and certainly should not have involved Britain. Well, until very recently, the consensus among historians was that Germany and Austria-Hungary were primarily responsible for the outbreak of the First World War. This is a Punch cartoon from, I think, 1917. There we have, of course, the Kaiser Bill, figure of death. Stop, stop, I'm tired, death. I started at your bidding, I stop when I choose. This is, of course, propaganda, but it's not to say it's entirely wrong. Rather than the Kaiser, pinning the responsibility solely on the Kaiser, although he has a rather greater responsibility for the outbreak of the war than many people believe, I think we should look at the German government, the German military, and not least the government of Austria-Hungary and their military. What happened in effect was that there was a clash of rival nationalisms in the Balkans between the declining Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Balkans really was their only sphere of influence that was left, and the rising small and quite aggressive state of Serbia. It is very clear indeed from the evidence that the Austro-Hungarian elite took the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo on the 28th of June 1914 as the pretext for a war to destroy Serbia. The Austrians did not want a major European, a world war. They wanted to destroy Serbia, but, and this is critical, they were quite prepared to risk a much greater catastrophe if it brought the defeat of Serbia closer. Why should this escalate? Because, of course, Serbia was the was protected, as it were, by Russia. Russia had lost out badly in a previous diplomatic crisis in 1908 because it was still recovering from the twin blows of defeat at the hands of the Japanese in 1905 and the abortive revolution. And in 1914, they were not going to be pushed around for the second time. Russia, of course, was allied with France, and Britain, indeed, although not formally allied with Russia or France, was there on the sidelines and had to be taken into account as well. So there is actually little doubt that the Austrians bear an absolutely huge slice of the blame, the guilt, if you like, for beginning the First World War. But the Germans do too. It seems pretty clear to me, again, from the evidence, and for those who are interested, an excellent book was published last year by Annika Mombauer, a German historian based at the Open University here, which is a collection of primary source documents in English from all the major powers. It is very clear from the evidence that Austria almost certainly would not have gone as far as they did without the explicit backing of Germany. And they got that. On 4th, 5th, June 1914, the Germans, the German elite, issued the so-called blank check. That is a guarantee of support for Austria, no matter what happened. And again, it is very clear the Germans were well aware of what the possible, even the likely outcome was going to be. That is a major war involving the European powers. The Germans went into it with their eyes open. Why they took this decision, historians still debate. Some from the school of the German historian Fritz Fischer, people such as John Rawl, who's just finished a magisterial biography of the Kaiser, which I recommend people to read, the third volume, if not the others. Fischer and the Fischerites would say that Germany had been actively planning for an aggressive war since at least 1912. Another version says that, well, maybe they're not actually actively planning to fight a war in the summer of 1914, as Fischer argued, but they are certainly prepared to run the risk of war in order to achieve their gains. At the very least, the so-called War Council of December 1912, which Fischer bases his arguments on, shows that very important people in the hierarchy, including the Kaiser himself, were prepared to run the risk of war to achieve aggressive foreign policy aims. So all of this, for me, makes it absolutely clear that the currently fashionable view, summed up in the title of Christopher Clark's best-selling and very influential book, The Sleepwalkers, the idea that somehow the states of Europe blundered into war, not knowing what they were doing, I simply think is wrong. The Germans and the Austrians were very well aware of what they were risking. Possibly the Germans were planning the much wider war of aggression that they ended up with. But, you know, for me, that those two states bear far more responsibility than any of the others, including Russia, which somebody sometimes gets trotted out as also as a guilty party. In a sense, the killer fact for me is that the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, proposed mediation or international conference on no less than six occasions during the July crisis. It is entirely possible that if an international conference had taken place, that Serbia would have been punished, but without having its security and independence destroyed, because I think the British would have sided with Austria, because there was a great deal of international outrage at the Archduke's assassination. But neither Austria nor Germany had the slightest interest in getting together around a table with the great powers of Europe. And for me, the great tragedy of Sir Edward Grey was he didn't realise this basic fact until very, very late in the day. So in my view, and in the view of many historians, Britain and her allies were fighting between 1914 and 18 a war of defence against an aggressive enemy. An enemy, the most dangerous one that Britain faced since Napoleon. And the fact that what came 25 years later was even worse, in that genocide was added to militaristic aggression, does not excuse the behaviour of Germany in the First World War. Incidentally, the final thing I'll say on this before moving on to talk about something else is that the picture I sometimes see painted, for example, by Neil Ferguson, perhaps you saw that television programme that he was involved with, along with myself and several others in January, the picture painted by Neil Ferguson of a democratic and benign Imperial Germany is not one that I recognise. Imperial Germany was a democracy of a sort, in there was an elected Reichstag, but it was largely toothless. The really important power, including the one to go to war, was held by a small elite around the Kaiser. Of course, as the war went on, Germany became progressively less democratic, with the emergence of what had been described in 1916 as a silent dictatorship of the key generals Hindenburg and Ludendorff. Okay, my second theme is to look at the military history of the war. First thing to say is that, in my view, far much too much attention is paid to this, the first day on the Somme. That, of course, is actually one of the few faked bits of footage from the Somme film. You only have to ask yourself, if a man was really filming from that angle, he'd be pretty much a target for any German sniping at him. Genuine footage from that film is normally shot from a very low angle. There's far less attention paid to this, which is the highly proficient army of 1918, and far too much attention, in my view, is time is spent on criticising these group of individuals, Field Marshal Haig and his top team of generals. They're taken on Armistice Day in 1918. The reason, of course, is quite simply because British losses in the First World War were far greater than in any war fought beforehand, and indeed in any war fought since. British losses in the Second World War were much, much lower than those in the First. Simple reason for that is Britain spent less time fighting the main enemy in the main theatre of operations in the Second World War than it did in the First World War. First World War, Britain had a bigger army engaged against the main enemy in the main theatre of operations throughout. In Germany, in the Second World War, that simply is not true. And I'm not denying for one moment that mistakes were made with horrendous consequences. We can look at the 1st of July 1916 and we can spot numerous mistakes that were made by the generals, including Haig. But arguably, in fact I do argue in my book, the Chief, the biggest mistake actually was made by another general. Let's see if I can spot him. Yeah, there, Sir Henry Rawlinson, 4th Army Commander on the 1st of July, who by ignoring Haig's explicit instructions about how to use mobile reserves threw away the opportunity to turn the 1st of July from a disaster into a success. Happy to take questions about that if you want me to later on. So why were casualties so heavy in the First World War? Well, I actually do a full-blown master's course on this very subject. I'll be shamelessly advertising it at the end of the session. But to give you a couple of headlines, the first one is the British Army had to grow hugely from a tiny army designed really for the sort of things the British Army has been doing in Afghanistan recently into a massive army fighting a major industrialised war against the most powerful army in the world. That would have tested anyone. So what we have is everybody from the senior generals who have never commanded at that level or on that scale before, down to the butchers, bakers and candlestick makers who joined the army in 1914 and form the bedrock of the force fighting on the Somme indeed afterwards. Everybody has to learn how to fight at this sort of warfare. This would have been a particularly brutal form of on-the-job training at any time. And it's worth comparing with the experience of the British Army in the Second World War, where after Dunkirk, most of the army spent the next 4 years training in the UK, something, you know, a luxury that the British Army in the First World War simply did not have. It would have been bad enough anyway. It's made even worse by the fact that a set of changes in warfare were coming about so profound, they have been described as a revolution in military affairs. Put crudely, if Napoleon had come back in 1914, he broadly would have recognised the sort of war that was being fought. If he delayed his return for another 4 years, no idea. The warfare of 1914 looks back to Napoleon, the warfare of 1918 looks forward to Blitzkrieg, and indeed the wars of today. It's about the introduction of new weaponry, such as gas and the tank, and the effective use of some pre-war weaponry, such as aircraft. And aircraft are particularly key. In 1914, if you wanted to fire at anything with an artillery piece, with a gun, and have any chance of hitting it, you really needed to be able to see it, the line of sight. Put an aeroplane up there, with an observer in the back, with a camera, and a primitive wireless radio, you can then radio information back to ground stations, which basically means that artillery can fire at things they cannot see. Suddenly, artillery fire, therefore battle, therefore the war, becomes much more lethal. Nowhere within range of artillery is suddenly safe. And so great is this change in warfare. For me, the surprising thing is not that the losses were so high and the gains were so low. It's actually they weren't even higher, and they made as many gains as they did. But, and this is a big but, by 1918, the British, at the same time as the French, but ahead of the Germans, had worked out how to use this new form of warfare. And so, rather than concentrating on 1st of July 1916, I think there's been a much greater concentration on the 100 days of victories, from August to November 1918, when this new form of warfare was applied with devastating effects on the Germans, leaving the Germans to capitulate, as we know, in November 1918. I've already mentioned the First World War as a total war, a war involving all the resources of a state, human, economic and technological. And we simply cannot separate out the home front from the rear area, not least because without the massive response of the home front to providing the weaponry, the munitions, the food and the moral support for the men in the trenches, Britain simply could not have won. Total wars, actually, when they come down to it, are competitions between societies as well as armies. And so much is about outlasting the enemy. The German home front, for all sorts of reasons, suffered more badly than did the British home front. The British naval hunger blockade had a lot to do with that. But the British home front proved to be remarkably resilient. I would simply make this point. In a democracy, and Britain was a democracy in the First World War, albeit an imperfect one, You simply cannot coerce people into supporting a war unless the state becomes something other than a democracy. And yet, by using powers of persuasion, and we're not talking about propaganda lying to people, simply so much as encouraging people to recognise the stakes for which they were fighting, the British Home Front remained firm through to the end of the war. Some research done a few years ago suggested that, amazingly enough, British morale, in a sense of the willingness to continue to fight Germany, was as high in 1918 that it was at any point in the war. Which brings me to my concluding points. I think that the British government's approach to commemorating the First World War is deeply flawed. Not least because it refuses to give a clear and unambiguous statement of why the war was fought, or even a clear and unambiguous statement about why the majority of people, while the war was going on, thought the war was fought. The Prime Minister, in his speech in October 2012, announcing the programme of commemorations, I think set the tone for this by announcing that the key dates that would be commemorated were things like Gallipoli and the First and the Somme defeats, but completely ignored the 100 days of victory in 1918. This is historical illiteracy. And that is the context in which things like the Lovey Letter can flourish. There seems to be a consensus that Britain should not celebrate the First World War. Well, I think the outbreak of the First World War is nothing to celebrate whatsoever. In fact, I think we're doing all this 4 years too early, 5 years too early. We should be concentrating on 2018. But celebrating has different means. It can mean admiring the achievements of a previous generation. I think that celebrating in that sense is entirely appropriate. We should be celebrating in a non-triumphalist way the success of the British state, the British people, British society in weathering the most dangerous challenge that Britain had known for 100 years. The fact that the war was won, that the peace was then lost, and war continued for another generation, is no reason to downplay the huge significance of the victory of 1918. This is, I'm well aware, an unpopular view, but I ask you to consider it. Thank you very much indeed.